Welcome to Discovering and Sharing Shuswap History.
Today's program is about the pioneer families at Seymour Arm, British Columbia, during the years 1908 to 1916. If anyone in our listening audience may be friends or neighbors to the list of the following family names, you are living next to the descendants of the pioneer families of the Shuswap era. In no particular order, some of the family names that settled in the Seymour Arm area were Allison, Davis, Innes, Hislop, Mackey, and Desnier. Other settling families were the Bjorkmans, Gilmans, Gilmores, Haynes, Holmans, Johnsons, Lloyds, Martins, Robillards, Schabels, Smith, Friesens, Lipsitz, Lunds, and Frasers. Of course, many local residents know and have heard extensive histories of the Collings and the Daniels family. The men and women who pioneered and built up the province of British Columbia were an enterprising lot. They needed to be tough and tenacious, hardworking, and have acquired the many skills needed to survive in the wilderness. The early 1900s were difficult for women, too. Very few had running water or anything more than a metal scrub board to wash clothes. And in childbirth, a woman would have to rely on a neighbor's friends and sometimes her husband just to see her through. These stalwart pioneer women were amazingly versatile and have contributed just as much as their hardworking men in the early settlement of the province. From the Fruitlands Development Corporation, numerous settlers bought land in the Seymour Arm area around 1908 to 1916. Just as many came to homestead in the surrounding region, including the South Side. Some men came alone or with their families to log or work in the mining venture on Grace Mountain. There were various reasons for the families deciding to one day leave Seymour Arm, and among them the bankruptcy of the Fruitlands Company and the heavy frost toll on fruit crops of 1916 had a major influence. And with World War I, there came the closure of the school. The harsh situations and conditions of these events motivated some families to move away. Of course, the isolated wilderness of that area of the Shuswap Lake region were a challenge of all who came to live there. Following are some of the brief histories of the oldest families who played a part in building the community of Seymour Arm, and in many cases, their descendants still dwell there today. The Innes family. George Innes came to Seymour Arm in the early 1900s. He worked in the logging industry and spent many, many years trapping. He also worked on the paddle wheel steamboats. George married Pearl Daniels in 1917, where the family lived in various places, including the old Hislop house just up from the hotel. When it became too difficult for the children to cross the water to the south side to go to school, the family moved across and lived in the Hooper place before building a home of their own at Seymour, when the school moved back across the water to Seymour Arm. Their children, Florence, Wes, Ron, and Alan, spent their early years in Seymour. Pearl, however, became ill in the early 1930s, and with a good possibility of the school closing and to be nearer to medical care, George decided to move the family in 1935 to Silver Creek near Salmon Arm. Pearl passed away in 1936, and George passed away in 1975. His son Wes died in 2007. the Hislop family. James and Helen Hislop originated from Galt, Ontario, building a home at Seymour around 1913. As well, they took out a homestead on the south side where they planted berries and fruit trees and had a cannery on the property. They were Scottish descendants and highly valued education for their children. James had university degrees from quite a few institutions, including McGill and Cornell. He was an engineer for the Canadian Pacific Railway and instrumental in the engineering of the intricate tunnels at the Rogers Pass. The Hislops went on to build another home in Salmon Arm in 1916, and they ended up spending time in both places, eventually one day giving up the Seymour property and living full-time in Salmon Arm. There they were actively involved in keeping the Church of Scotland alive. James Hislop died at the age of 95 in 1955. The Allison family. George Henderson Allison came to Canada from Scotland in 1908 after seeing a poster advertising Seymour Arm Fruitlands. His wife, Marion, née Runciman, and son, Bill, joined him the following year. First living in a tent, they eventually built a home close to the hotel, which subsequently burnt down. Their second home was landscaped with beautiful gardens. George worked as a guide to affluent Americans who came to fish and hunt in the area. He also worked in trapping, logging, and mining, and was a postmaster for a short time. Daughters Sylvia and Jean were born in Canada. Jean, however, succumbed to diabetes at the age of 6 and was buried in the old Seymour Arm graveyard. The family lived and farmed at Seymour Arm well into the 1930s, when they relocated to Kamloops. They are well known around Kamloops for Allison Nurseries, which operated for many years. George was well known, though, for his bagpipe playing. Early residents of Seymour Arm remember him well. When he was shooed out of a house because of the noise he made, he would then walk up and down outside, continuing to play his pipes. Bill Allison married Irene, the daughter of Clarence and Minnie Daniels, another Seymour Arm family. Bill and Irene went on to have 5 children, Marion, George, Edith, Bill, and Jean. Bill Sr. was laid off from his job for the CPR Railway in 1938, but using ingenuity and grit, he overcame that obstacle, and he managed to load their house on a raft and floated his family with him all around Shoeshop Lake, where he cut trees off the shores of the lake to make railway ties. Irene sometimes worked as a cook in logging camps. The family managed to stay self-reliant, planting a garden on shore and keeping a cow and chickens on the raft. The cow grazed on the shore whenever possible. In the winter, the family would anchor the raft close to the shore at Beach Bay, where they looked after cabins. Bill went back to work for the CPR in 1942, and then the family moved to Revelstoke. In a tape interview, Bill talks about the early days at Seymour Arm as a young lad when he wanted to be a donkey puncher, which was the man who ran the donkey engines used in logging. He also loved the boats and remembers spending as much time as he could on the old steamers. Later, he compiled a history of steamers operating on the Shuswap Lake system. Bill's son, George, presently lives at Eagle Bay. He worked for the CPR for 37 years and passed on the love of railways to his son, Rick, who also works for the CPR. The Dasnier family. René Charles Dasnier, born 1878, died 1939, first visited the Seymour Arm region around 1904, accompanied by his brother, Edmund. René returned to England and married Edith Annie. The couple returned to Canada, where they crossed the nation in a covered wagon pulled by horses. Their daughter, Gertrude, was born in Stettler, Alberta, in 1910, and René Charles Jr.'s in Kamloops in 1912. The young family arrived at Seymour Arm in 1913, taking out a homestead on Dasnier's Bay, which was named after them. The family first lived in a tent before building a log home. They must have had a productive garden, as their potatoes and cabbages won prizes at the Seymour Fall Fair in 1915. After 10 years, around 1923, the family returned to England. Gertrude later became a nun, dying in 1989. René Jr. wanted to return to Canada, but this was delayed by the war. Finally, in 1950, René Jr., who had married in England, returned with his wife, Phyllis, and their three children, Yvonne, Peter, and Phyllis. His mother, Edith, accompanied them. René Sr. had died in England. The family lived in the Seymour Arm Hotel while building what was planned to be a temporary home on the southeast corner of the old homestead. The home was built of slabs obtained from Alan Reed's sawmill, then located on Freeman Point. Daughter Yvonne remembers helping her father haul the lumber for the home back with horse teams. The funds never became available to build a better home. René's nickname was Pete, and when he managed to get his boat stuck on a sandbar in the river, his nickname became Sandbar Pete. Yvonne reminisces about the trips on the Stephanie with Captain Frank Smith. Once the river was so rough that they lost all the goods off the barge, including her grandmother's suitcase. Yvonne recalls rowing to Seymour Arm twice a week in a boat made by her father, who was, as you could tell, a jack of all trades. There she would collect their groceries and mail. A grocery list would be given to the boat captain, and he would fill their order to be delivered on his next trip. The Dasnieres were known to keep chickens and ducks, geese and rabbits, as well as their workhorses. Yvonne remembers eating a lot of canned food, clem, prem, and spam, in those early days. Mrs. Dasnieres moved with the children to Salmon Arm during the winter months, though, in order to allow the children to attend school. The family lived at Dasnieres Bay until selling the old homestead in 1966. René and his wife Phyllis then moved to Salmon Arm. Phyllis passed away in 1979 and René 10 years later. Yvonne left Dasnieres Bay in 1955 to work in Kamloops, where she married Fred Hill. She later lived in Alberta but returned to Seymour Arm for the summer months. Yvonne and Fred have four children. Peter remained a bachelor working for the Department of Highways. He bought land at Seymour Arm in 1959, and he moved the shack from Dasnieres Bay onto this land. The old homestead has evolved into a very nice house today. The Mackey family. Ino Mackey married Fay Kelly in 1922, and about that same time began working for R.W. Brune, operating a small boat called the Peter Pan, which was used to tow poles to the pole yard at Sicamous. He also worked on a larger boat used for the same purpose, the Elvira. Later, Ino bought the Elvira, operating his own business. The Elvira later burned and sank at Sinamosan Narrows. Ino and Fay had two sons, Gordon, born in 1928, and Norman in 1932. Their children also went on to receive an education. Gordon worked in banking, and Norman worked for BC Hydro. In 1959, Ino died, and in 1966, Gordon and Norman returned to Sicamous and bought the ferry service from Frank Smith. The brothers began with two boats, the Stephanie and the MPF. Later, they built the Phoebe Ann, which was named after their grandmother. For over 80 years, the Mackeys, fathers and sons, worked on the waters of Shuswap Lake, supplying a valuable service to Seymour Arm families. Gordon was a magistrate from 1972 to 1976 and mayor of Sicamous during the years 1989 to 1999. Gordon is still active in the Sicamous community with the Historical Society, theater, and other endeavors. Norman and his wife Joyce own Ainsworth Hot Springs for many years and are presently living in Vernon. The Davis family. Bill Davis was married and had five children, two girls and three boys. He was a trapper and a farmer. He was well known around the area for his fiddle playing, and older settlers remember him playing at many dances held at the Seymour Arm Hotel. The family lived down by the present-day wharf. Tragically, though, one day, when Mrs. Davis was out with the children in the boat, she fell out of the boat, a victim of a heart attack, not drowning. The children stayed in the boat until it grounded on the shore. Bill went on to stay in Seymour Arm for a few more years, but the children went to live with relatives. The Daniels family of Seymour Arm, Shuswap Lake, British Columbia. Members of the Daniels family have resided at Seymour Arm for over 100 years. And during that time, they have worked in trapping, mining, farming, logging, and numerous business ventures. Through these years, they have been an integral part of their community and generous benefactors, as well as the first to offer assistance to those in need. Forrest Nelson Daniels, whose parents were immigrants from Wales, is known as the first white settler with descendants still residing at Seymour Arm. Forrest, a blacksmith and a carpenter from Cobalt, Ontario, had traveled across Canada with the RCMP in the later 1800s. He married Caroline Victoria, and the Daniels made their way to the British Columbia interior and settled in Armstrong, setting up a blacksmith shop there as well as homesteading. They lived there for 14 years. Around 1906, though, Forrest was looking for a new place to homestead, and he began to explore the Seymour Arm area. He returned to Armstrong in 1908 for his family, packed them up, and they then traveled to Sicamous, where they loaded their children into a rowboat, which pulled a barge with two horses on it to the Seymour Arm area. Forrest had preempted a homestead at the end of the arm, now known today as Daniels Bay, also called Bughouse Bay. Forrest and his wife Caroline Victoria had 13 children, 11 boys and 2 girls. When the Seymour Arm Fruitlands Company began development in 1909, the Daniels family helped clear the land and construct many of the buildings. Forrest built the hotel, which is still in use, and the Daniels children attended the Fruitland School. Daniels was the first postmaster of that new development. Like other early pioneer families, the Daniels lived by hunting, fishing, farming, trapping, and logging, according to the season. They were self-sufficient with big gardens and farm animals. And for a while, Forrest worked hauling supplies from Seymour Arm to the Cotton Belt Mine trailhead with a team of his own horses. However, Mr. Lundy, the owner of the mine, was nervous about hauling dynamite on the horses' backs, and Forrest ended up having to pack it on his own back. Forrest Daniels died in 1914. After, Caroline moved to Vancouver to live with a relative and died there in 1925. Of their 13 children, only Clarence and Vern stayed at Seymour Arm. Clarence married Minnie Goodboot from nearby Albus. Clarence and Minnie homesteaded on the south side. They had 3 children, Irene, Myrtle, and Edward. They did leave Seymour Arm in the late 1930s. Vern enlisted and was sent overseas in World War I, where he was severely wounded and returned to Seymour Arm in 1921. Vern later married Minnie Goodboot's sister, Nellie. Vern had preempted 160 acres across the bay from the Seymour Arm town site. To this, he added a soldier's grant of 80 acres. Vern and Nellie went on to have 6 children, Ernest, 1922, Arnold, 1923, Alfred, 1925, Violet, 1927, Shirley, 1933, and Abby, 1935. The Daniels worked hard, clearing land and farmed cattle, horses, pigs, and chickens, as well as cultivating a large garden. In 1937, with the closure of the school, the Vern Daniels family moved to Salmon Arm to allow the children to attend high school. They returned to their old farm at Seymour Arm every summer. Vern was disabled due to his war injuries, and for this he received a small, inadequate pension. He still managed, though, to work on farms to support his family. Elf Daniel says his mother was thrifty, and they never, ever went hungry. In an interview by The Shopper's Guide in 1978, Nellie and Vern said their best times were the early days at Seymour Arm. They remember the dances, surprise parties, basket socials, work bees, community picnics, and the fall fairs. Arnold and Ernie joined the forces and were sent overseas in World War II. Arnold died at Normandy. Ernie, though, returned to Seymour Arm in 1945 and never left again. Elf was too young to serve, but his high school years were cut short by World War II as help was needed on area farms. Elf eventually enlisted in 1945, just as the war ended. In 1963, Elf saw a need for a store at Seymour Arm as lake traffic was beginning to increase. The first shop, a small building on the shore, was in service for 4 years, initially opening only in summer. Merchandise was brought in by barge or by Elf's boat, the Lorelei. Later, supplies were trucked in. To accommodate an increase in clientele, Elf purchased his first floating building, which had once been a restaurant, and towed it to the current location on Daniels Bay. Business increased, and so did the constant deterioration caused by the exposure to diverse weather conditions. In 1995, Elf upgraded the store, and in 2007, he sold it to a local resident. Elf and Ernie continued to live on their grandfather's old farmstead in Daniels Bay. For many years, Ernie took care of the farm, Elf ran the store, and both looked after their father's farm on the south side while logging in winter. Ernie and Elf have both passed away in recent years. Later, Abby returned to live at Seymour Arm, assisting Ernie and Elf with the store and logging as well as working on road maintenance. Shirley and her husband Frank Quast returned to Seymour Arm for the retirement years. Violet and her husband Lynn Hamilton also spent 10 years of their retirement at Seymour Arm.
For more information on these and other stories, please contact the Salmon Arm Museum at Haney Heritage Park or visit us when we are open during the summer season.
The Calling Families by Estelle Noakes, one of the founding families of Seymour Arm, located at the northern tip of Shuswap Lake. Charles John Collings made his decision to immigrate to Canada after receiving correspondence from a friend just returning from a Canadian visit. Always intrigued by greener pastures, the glowing accounts from the standpoint of picturesqueness and opportunities for young people inspired him, and he said to his family, "Chappies, let's move to Canada." He went straight to the piano and played to the west," and the decision was made. Charles, 63, his wife Melosa, and their two sons, Carl, 20, and Guy, 19, arrived in Seymour Arm, British Columbia, in May of 1910, after traveling by steamer, train, and then boat. Seymour Arm was only accessible by water. Charles, an internationally known watercolorist, was looking for a place where the family could farm and he could paint. The Collings were an aristocratic and well-educated English family. Both Charles and his wife were pianists. Melora was a concert pianist. In those days, Seymour Arm was in the early stages of being developed by the Seymour Arm Fruitlands Company. Charles traded a painting for some land. The Collings first lived in a tent until Christmas, when they moved into a cabin, which would be the living room of a larger dream, an elegant mansion in the wilderness. After extensive planning, a large Tudor-style home was mapped out by Charles. His sons began to implement the plans, an undertaking that would consume the next 20 years. Eventually, though, the home would feature a conservatory, a large grand staircase, a large rock fireplace, a room for the large Brunswick billiard table, and a place, of course, for the grand piano. It had running water and bathroom with a tub and a toilet. A music box had a special place. It was a gift from Theodore Roosevelt. Books were very important to the Collings family, and they accumulated hundreds over the years. From these books, they learned the many crafts that would allow them to live in the wilds, including how to build a boat, snowshoe construction, general carpentry, plumbing, gardening skills, trapping. Outside, the landscape was superb, a special feature being the rose trellis walkway. Guy was a woods craftsman, and through the years, almost all the furniture for the mansion, plus the boats, the snowshoes, and many other projects were fashioned by him. Both sons worked in construction, were trappers, hunting, and loggers. Carl was an avid photographer, and there still remain, in the old mansion, boxes of his glass slides. Guy, too, left a wonderful collection of butterflies and moths. Any woman who has lived in a remote bush setting can guess what Melora's life was like. Always determined to hold on to the vestiges of civilization, she insisted on bringing culture to the wilderness. They always dressed for dinner, which was laid with good china, crystal, and silver, and the courtesies of their culture were never, ever forgotten. If there were dinner guests, Guy would act as a butler, eating after the others were through. Music was a big part of their life, and often in the evenings, Charles and Melora would play a duet by candlelight. In 1918, the Collings returned to England to sell and promote some of Charles's paintings. Their return to Canada, though, was hastened a year later by Carl's deteriorating health. Always frail, he had been much healthier in Canada. Through the years, the Collings traveled many times, but their principal home was always their Tudor mansion in Seymour Arm. The family managed to live off the paintbrush of their father, C.J.C., as well as the fruit and vegetables they grew and the work the sons did in logging and construction. They even kept and sold honey, canned and smoked salmon, and hunted for wild game. For a time, they ran their own home canning factory. On the Collings' first voyage across Canada by train, Charles became smitten with the lofty peaks of the Rocky Mountains, a fascination that would last a lifetime and lead him to be dubbed by international art critics as the recluse of the Rockies. Charles Collings painted a lifetime and history of Western Canada, which is his gift to the country he loved. It was here in British Columbia that he found his true and lasting inspiration for his art. He was also known as one of the best colorists in the world and was primarily a poet-painter, his viewers enchanted by the magic of his simple subjects. Many of his paintings are stored at the White Gallery in Banff. Charles died in 1931. Down through the years, the Colling Mansion was used at times as a school and as a church. The family was a close-knit unit. The sons never married. Melora died in 1936, son Carl in 1950, and Guy lived quietly in the mansion alone for the next 25 years. An old world gentleman, Guy made many trips outside, though. He loved art and theater. Guy invited the public to visit and gave historical tours of the old mansion. In his last years, he had been negotiating with the government to have them purchase the old home as a museum and art gallery for the works of Charles John Collings. That project didn't work out. The unique combination of a family's pioneering spirit and old English charm, which thrived in Seymour Arm for 66 years, came to an end with the passing of the last Collings, Guy, in 1975. The old mansion was left to his good friend, John Rivette, who was very surprised at the inheritance and intimidated by the responsibility. The old place was badly in need of major renovation. John sold his own property at Seymour Arm in order to pay the hefty inheritance tax and the major construction on the Collings mansion. John carried on the Collings courtesy, though, allowing the public to tour the historical old Tudor home. Through the years, thousands of people have enjoyed their trip back in time in the old Tudor mansion, a tribute to the work of some true pioneers and John Rivette. John Rivette passed away in 2015. The heritage home is still lived in by John's descendants. A number of the pioneer families in the Shuswap Lake chose to live in the Seymour Arm region. The L. Bass family by Estelle Noakes. L. Bass, for whom the community Elvis is named, is known as the first permanent settler of the Seymour Arm region, arriving just after the turn of the 20th century. L. was born in the eastern United States. He had never known his mother and father, having been brought up in foster homes. At a young age, he traveled west across the United States, either on horseback or in wagon trains, taking in all the gold rushes along the way and finally reaching California before heading north into Canada. Al's main interest was prospecting for gold, but he was also a trapper and a hunter, and he often traveled alone. He was robbed many times and had some very close calls. Al was never really lucky with his prospecting. He and his wife built a log cabin on the south side of Seymour Arm and lived there for many years. Although little is known about Al's wife, a Seymour resident remembers that she liked nice furnishings and good china. There is no evidence that the Basses had children. Mrs. Bass moved to Sicamous after Al died and became a housekeeper for Andy Berg. Andy was also a past resident of the Seymour area. Andy looked after Mrs. Bass until she died. Al Bass is buried in the old Seymour Arm graveyard. The community Elvis. First named Trapper Town, there's little evidence left of the trapping and logging activities that took place at Elvis. It was once a busy settlement on the Seymour Arm area of Shuswap Lake. Now the land has almost entirely returned to forest, and barely a trace can be found of the early inhabitation. In 1920, though, Elvis boasted a score of small dwellings housing many single men and a few families. The Arrow Lakes Lumber Company, which also owned steamboats, had a mill at Elvis, the power for which was generated by a water turbine in the creek. An enormous flume was built to bypass the falls and bring timber to the lake. You may still find pieces of the old generator and flume when hiking the Elvis Falls trails, now included in the present-day Elvis Provincial Park. In 1920, the community had a store, a post office, and a large cookhouse by the beach. The cookhouse was a popular spot for dances. Often people would travel by boat from Seymour Arm to attend these dances. Elvis was a call port for steamers bringing supplies. The community was named for Al Bass, and many campfire stories were told about Bass days in the American Wild West. For some years, boats were built on Steamboat Bay. In fact, the Maud Annis II was built there. When the mill was running, there was approximately 150 people in the vicinity, working in logging, trapping, and some farming. The Fall Fair in Seymour Arm, 1912, documents 13 participants from the Elvis with entries in categories including vegetables and apples and, quote, best cleared preemption, unquote, which documents farming development at Elvis. The mill, though, got into financial difficulty and the population began to dwindle away. And in 1925, the post office closed. A decline in trapping pretty much finished off the settlement, and its brief prosperity came to an end. At that time, residents trapped for bears, marten, link, muskrat, otter, and coyote. A lumber mill did run again in the 1940s at Elvis, but soon closed. Alba's today an especially beautiful area with a series of enchanting waterfalls, small pools, and a lovely beach, is now a provincial park.
The Noakes family's contribution to music on the North Shoe Swap by Estelle Noakes, read by Estelle Noakes. The Noakes family, Harold Florence, and their sons Stan and Bert arrived by CP Railway at Chase just in time for the Dominion Day celebrations in 1912. Harold unpacked his snare drum and joined the Chase band. He was unable to march in the parade, though, due to a broken leg. Once settled at their homestead on Magna Bay, then called Steamboat Bay, it became evident that the settlers would benefit from musical, social functions, and Harold offered to organize some musical entertainment at the Celista School, then known as Shoeswap North. On Saturday mornings, Harold taught the older students as well as any adults who cared to join them. Soon, the first drum and fife band was formed. This band provided entertainment for community functions until 1914, when World War I began and many members left to join the forces. In 1918, the Noakes family moved to Victoria for employment opportunities, returning again to the Magna Bay homestead in 1919. The same year, Harold, on drums, Florence, playing the piano, and Tom Brown formed a dance orchestra and played for the first dance at Magna Bay School, New Year's Eve of 1919. The floor was only shiplap, but it did not dampen the enthusiasm of the crowd. There was no piano at the school, so Florence's piano was transported to dances by sleigh or wagon. Mr. Harry Reed of Eagle Bay always offered his piano tuning services. Stan played the violin, and Bert, playing the saxophone, began playing with their parents at an early age, between 6 and 8 years old. They would play until they became tired and then fall asleep in a makeshift bed behind the piano. There were many lumber camps in the early years around the community. Some of these loggers were accomplished musicians, and they would join in, adding their expertise to the enjoyment of the crowd. The Noakes Orchestra were a highlight, playing for the lake excursions on Bill Louie's boat, the C.R. Lamb. They often played further afield, too, at Sorrento, Tappan, and Salmon Arm. In the early days, they and their instruments were transported by the Andover, one of the logging company boats. By 1924, a ferry was in place between Scotch Creek and Sorrento, and the first cars in the community were purchased. Then Walter or Wilfred Nelson transported the band to most functions. There was quite a technique involved in getting themselves and their instruments into a Model T. Harold would ride with his arm out the window, supporting the drum on the running board. Harold never had a car or a driver license. Due to employment opportunities, the Noakes family moved to Chase and Kamloops, but always returned to Magna Bay. After 1930, they never left again, providing the music for dances around the community. Stan and Bert were often working elsewhere, but when visiting would join the family band once again. When the community hall was opened in 1934, Florence's piano was transported to the hall for summer dances. By then, the roads had improved and truck transport was available. Winter functions continued to be held in the Magna Bay School until it burned in 1950. The dances were always well attended, and 3:30 in the morning arrived much too soon, with the crowds calling for more as the home waltz signaled the end of the evening. The Noakes Orchestra was still providing the music for the biweekly dances throughout the 40s. Through the years, both Harold and Florence gave music lessons. About 10 years ago, a gentleman, Dan Burns, contacted me. He was dying of cancer, and going through his belongings, he found a flute that my grandfather had given him. My grandfather had also given him free lessons in the short time he lived near them, and my grandmother had made a little cloth case for the flute. Dan had kept the flute for more than 60 years and now wanted to return it to the Noakes family. Music remained a passion for both Pert and Stan, Bert always played with a band or had his own band. As well, he continued to teach music, making up his own lessons to do so, and giving schools permission to use these lessons as well. Stan also continued with music throughout his lifetime. Harold passed away in 1965, Florence in 1967. Bert passed away in 2001, his saxophone by his side. Stan passed away in 2006.
Why do they call it Engineer's Point? During the construction of the CPR, some of the supervising engineers had their camp located here on Shuswap Lake. Falkland. This little settlement was named in compliment to Colonel Falkland Warren, CMG, CB. Retired from the Royal Horse Artillery, he made his home here in 1893 and proved a good friend to other settlers. Grindrod. After Edmund Grindrod, the first CPR inspector of telegraphs in BC in 1886, later a farmer near Kamloops. Harold Park. After Dr. Dundas Harold, who acquired the property in 1906. Hanukwa Lake, a Shuswap Indian word meaning one lake only. Called Hill, from the Shuswap native word for east, referring to the Shuswap people living in this dialect area at the eastern side of traditional Shuswap territory. Little River, over many centuries, the steady outward growth of the Adams River Delta was cut off Little Shuswap Lake from Big Shuswap Lake. The short stretch of water joining the two Shuswap lakes is called Little River, but on a modern map is mistakenly identified as Little South Thompson River. Magna Bay. In Latin, magna means great. In early days, because of the sternwheelers docked in this large bay, it was known as Steamboat Bay. Malaqua. Chinook jargon word meaning mosquito. Mara Lake, after John Andrew Mara, an overlander of 1862. Prospering in British Columbia, he became Speaker of the Legislature and later a Member of Parliament. Nisqually Lake, an anglicized version of the name of the Shuswap Indian chief, often spelled Nisqually. Pukashun Mountain, the name of this mountain west of Seymour Arm, can be translated as White Rock.
My name is Dorothy Rolin. I'm the current president of the Salmon Arm branch of the Okanagan Historical Society. If you have stories or memories you'd like to share with this program, please call Voice of the Shuswap at 250-463-5026 or email info@voiceofthesuswap.ca. Discovering and sharing Shuswap history.
This radio program was made possible by a Government of Canada New Horizons grant, helping celebrate Canada's 150th anniversary.